This is the Play to Win podcast from Aconite Books, with me, James Wallace. This first series of the podcast accompanies my new book, Everybody Wins, Four Decades of the Greatest Board Games Ever Made, out now in the UK and coming to the US, Canada and Australia in spring 2023. Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Everybody Wins, a podcast that runs in association with, alongside and occasionally overlapping with the book Everybody Wins, Four Decades of the Greatest Board Games Ever Made by me, James Wallace. This episode, we're looking at the years 2016 to the present. Not quite a decade, but an interesting time nonetheless. If the previous decade had been characterized by no clear themes other than a few new mechanics, some clever titles, but nothing really defining the decade, 2016 was almost defined by the game that won that year, Codenames, by Vlada Chavatil, a Czech designer and a Czech publisher. It's a clever and gregarious game of guessing groups of words to identify spies. It's not really about spies at all. It's an abstract game with a loose theme. That doesn't seem to have impeded its success at all. It sold a million copies within its first year. And that's really defined the last few years, certainly as far as the Spiel des Jahres is concerned, and I think as far as a lot of the market is concerned. We've seen a continuing outgrowth of social games, games aimed at people who perhaps aren't au fait with modern board games, who aren't already gamers, much more accessible, much more immediate games. No less interesting, but sometimes actually more fun. Joining me for this episode, I'm enormously grateful to have two giants of the field. I don't think there's any other way of describing them. On one hand, we have Leslie Scott, who is best known as the creator of, I think, 80 million copy seller Jenga, a game that's almost become a folk game. People assume that it's a traditional game. There are countless knockoffs on the market, but no, 1983, I think it was launched?
It was launched in 1983, yes.
And Matt Leacock, who has been the man of the last few years, the creator of Pandemic, the perfectly timed game. Please tell us a little more about yourselves. Leslie?
Well, I think you've probably said the thing that people would know me for best is that I did create Jenga and launched it in 1983. And since then, I started a company called Oxford Games, which was ostensibly to publish games that I then went on to design. When I did design games for to commission for other people, but Oxford Games, we published I think something in the order of about 40 games over its lifetime from 83 till, well, from 91 actually was when I established Oxford Games through to today. It's in that sort of order.
Fantastic. And Matt?
Yeah, let's see. So I've been designing games full-time now since 2014. Best known for Pandemic, which came out in 2008. I've had a run of co-ops since then. Forbidden Island, Thunderbirds, games like that. I've got an upcoming game called Daybreak. So I've tackled the pandemic. Now I'm moving on to the climate crisis.
Yes. Fantastic. Basically with your finger on the pulse. Leslie, I mean, what we're talking about really is the last 8 or 10 years of games history. This is the fifth episode of the 5 decades that the book kind of covers. And one of the defining trends of this, along with co-op games, which we'll come on to, is the rise of social games as a major force within the market. And it seemed that for a long time, the hobby end of the market, the more serious gamers, looked down at the party end, the social games, the family games. Why do you think that is?
I actually found that quite a difficult question to answer, because for me personally, I enjoy, I think, what people would, the hobby end would call the sort of party game as such. So I don't know that I really do understand why it would be looked down upon. I think it's possibly that the game, I mean, I'm finding my way to an answer here, because I think the game element of a party game, if that's what my kind of games are called, it is almost, it's there to actually, you don't, the game itself is there to create a sort of social interaction between people, which possibly, it's more there for that point. I mean, I see my role as a games designer of these kinds of games is to actually provide a sort of platform on which other people, the people playing actually sort of, it's their interaction with each other. I'm not, I don't know whether that isn't what you do with role, sort of the more hobby game as well, but I would suspect that the actual storyline behind the a hobby game is possibly more an important part of the game.
I wonder if it's about the nature of the interaction more, the way that people interact, because, you know, social games, party games, there it's the fun is more front and center, and, you know, it's more about your, as the games designer, you're setting up the joke and then allowing the players to deliver the punchlines.
I think that's an extremely good way of putting it. I mean, I certainly see that. That's the kind of game that I enjoy, is actually where the game, the pieces are there as a way of actually sparking off an interaction with the people that you're with. I mean, I don't know whether that would be how I would describe some of the games that I've designed, which are word games. But even there, the word game is, I mean, I provide a whole bunch of tiles, but it's actually you, the player, that it's your skill, your wit, your engagement that comes to the fore in that. The tiles just become a sort of literally a tool. And I suspect in hobby games, actually, I should think it's a lot harder to design, is the truth of it, because you've got to build in an awful lot more of the story than you do in the kind of games that I generally design.
This is a question I actually had noted down for potentially later on. Is it easier to design a successful strategy game or a successful social game? I mean, it's easy to design games generally, and, you know, social games tend to have less rules, but I think the structure perhaps has to be more carefully balanced to create the kind of the appeal. Matt, as well as the heavyweights that you're known for, you've done some lighter, some simpler games as well.
I have. You know, I think I find the simpler stuff so much harder. I think it's pretty easy to put together a lot of content and call it a game and have it function and have a little bit of something for everything, like a kitchen sink sort of game. But to strip something down to just its core, just one little element, and have it fun and hold people's attention for a good amount of time is really an art. And I think it's, you know, sometimes it catches, sometimes it's, you know, hits the zeitgeist of the moment and everybody's just in on it, and other times everyone looks at it and goes, okay, well, that's fine, and then they move on. So I think timing is part of it, and then it's just really difficult, I think.
Yeah, so a social game that sticks around, that people want to come back and play again and again, and that grows with the group or different group members is, you know, they're rare and beautiful things when you come across them. Just looking at my shelf, Leslie, I've had a copy of Ex Libris, which I think was one of Oxford's first or very early games.
It was a very early game, yes.
Which is, I mean, it is essentially the dictionary game, or it's known as a folk game, known as first lines, last lines. And you take the first line of a novel and write it down, and everyone has to try and write down their own version of the same thing. They're all mixed up and you have to identify them. But it's packaged beautifully. It's one of the first games I've seen that's packaged as if it was a book, and the cards are lovely. And there's a real tone of this being a literary thing, which I think makes an enormous difference. So presentation, to what extent? I mean, the games designers design, in people's minds, games designers come up with mechanics and the you know, the rough outline of the board. But to what extent are the fine details, the presentation of Jenga, or the fact that the Jenga blocks are all slightly different sizes, so that sometimes they'll slide easily and sometimes they'll stick and it's unpredictable, which I think is one of the masterstrokes of the game. Was that deliberate? Did it happen by accident? I'm asking several questions all at once here.
I'll unpick that. First of all, presentation, I think, is incredibly important. But I don't know whether that's peculiar to my kind of game. I mean, when I after I had done Jenga, which, by the way, to answer one of your questions, is absolutely. It was completely deliberate. And the most difficult thing about turning that idea into a product was the fact that those blocks are all randomly and very slightly different from each other. That's key to that. So when you're going back to one of the other things you said about sort of the whole idea of whether it's something that's simple or simply just a party game is simple to design, the answer is absolutely no. I would say the more simplicity you're going for, the more difficult it is to design something. And I don't mean just games. I mean anything. I mean everything that when you come up with a when you're looking at any sort of design solution, the most satisfactory thing is that it looks almost too simple to have been deliberately designed is quite key. Packaging, I think, in my case, because after Jenga, I went very, very deliberately to what would be probably considered a quite a niche market. In that, I mean, at the time I'm talking about, there were no bookshops and things like that did not sell games, and certainly museums and places like that did not have games as part of their and more sort of gift shops. Apart from sort of things like rather beautiful sets of chess or chess pieces or backgammon or something like that, you didn't go to those places to buy your games. You went to toy shops to buy games, and I very, very deliberately moved out of the toy shop world or toy outlets and decided to go into essentially more the gift world. Where, of course, packaging is absolutely key. So, I mean, the look of it mattered tremendously to what I wanted from something.
Matt, to what extent do you, as the designer of, I mean, because Pandemic's look of the components, we'd already had a number of games, the piles of small cubes games, you know, Puerto Rico and Agricola had come along, but Pandemic's acrylic cubes are so distinctive and at the same time so appealing and so beautiful. Did you have any say, any input into the physical end of the production? Or
yeah, the Z-Man studio has involved me in a lot of that stuff, but I gotta say they're really good at what they do. Sophie Gravel at the head at the time has just made like some amazing choices when it comes to product design. I mean, if you look at the one that stands out for me is Azul. Mm. Where you've got the pieces in that are just, you know, square and they clack together and they've got that very satisfying feel. And I think that game helped prove that people were willing to pay a little bit more for that sort of thing. I know that she was, a lot of people were not expecting that game to do well at the price point that it was set at. I think it was like $40 at the time. And, you know, it's a fairly lightweight game, but because the pieces are nice, it raised the price, and it kind of proved that the at least the hobby market was willing to pay for quality. And I think that that kind of set the tone for a lot of games to come.
Yeah, no, it's such a gorgeous production job, that one. It's just, I mean, a game of laying tiles in a medieval cathedral or medieval palace that actually has tiles. I mean, they're not glazed tiles, they're not ceramic tiles, they're resin, I think. But the feel of it, just the capturing the tactility of it all. And we're back to Jenga again, the physicality of Jenga, which is all about, you know, those beautiful wooden pieces. And I know Hasbro, they've done plastic versions, which I don't think have caught on. They've not had the same stick in the market. But it's the physicality of the wood pieces and the way they feel, and you want the tower to stay up. And then that glorious moment where it comes down and that cathartic crash. It's become the standard by which most of the dexterity games are judged, I think. And there's more and more kind of dexterity in physical games. I'm looking across the table to the copy of Throw Avocado that my daughter has left there, which is, you know, uses foam avocados, which it kind of squishy foam, and they're just beautifully silly things. Do you feel like you laid the way, you set the stage for a lot of these games that have come subsequently to not just to succeed but to exist at all?
not sure I feel I would think of it in those terms, but I think there is a truth to that, in that once Jenga took off, I mean, it took, you know, it wasn't an instant success. It took me quite a while, and it really wasn't until I could afford for it to be promoted properly, which was basically once Erwin Toy in Canada took it on, and they had the wherewithal to sort of promote it. Prior to that, I had to demonstrate it everywhere. And when I demonstrated it, people sort of got it immediately. But just looking at a stack of wooden bricks, however nice they look, there was no sense of, wow, this actually might be quite fun to play. So it was quite a challenge. So, I mean, to answer your question, I think the closest thing that I've ever heard them sort of say it was like is pickup sticks or Mikado or, you know, whatever.
Spillikins, I think my grandmother used to call them.
Which is not like at all. So, but it has that sort of element, I suppose, of taking something away. But the idea that I know that things like sort of piling things on top of each other has become quite an appealing part of sort of game playing at the now, and it nothing like that did exist before Jenga that I know of anyway. And so, yes, maybe it did pave the way.
I mean, other than building houses of cards, which, you know, is very much a solo pursuit and quite a frustrating one.
Yes, that's possibly the closest.
You mentioned having to demonstrate the games, and one of the great regrets of many games designers or games publishers is that you have to find a way to explain what the game is to people. You can't package the game designer in every copy. But again, at the time we're talking about, the last few years, with increased use, publishers using QR codes to lead to a short demonstration of the game, online videos, online tutorials, teaching people, we're finally getting away from the dreaded rule book. Matt, your game, I mean, Pandemic in particular, which has been a huge hit over the last few years for zeitgeist, partly zeitgeist reasons, but I think has proved to be a gateway game for an awful lot of people as well. If you're not familiar with that style of game, that is not a simple game to learn and to understand. There's some quite complicated principles in there. How did you approach that? How did you get around that problem?
I had just tried to make it as simple as I could. I mean, to be honest, I mean, it was a much, much, much harder game to play in prototype form, I'll tell you that. So I tried to crack through as far as I could. Yeah, despite its complexity, I think it's been successful. I think it was like the simplest co-op game of its style for the time, right? I mean, it was, if you're looking at cooperative games, they weren't really proven as a category at the time. Yeah,
there games was, like there was one. There was Reiner Knizia's Lord of the Rings,
which
was 2000, which really kind of showed that it could be done, but I don't. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a flood after that.
Yeah, I think that one was really big. I mean, you compare it to Arkham Horror, which takes 4 hours or whatnot. You know, so
God, I had the original Arkham, the Chaosium edition of Arkham Horror, sure. And that was like six. That was a nightmare.
Yeah, you basically spent a whole day on it, and so I think with Pandemic, you could play it in 45 to 60 minutes, where even Lord of the Rings took a while to set up and go through all the different exceptions and cases and so on.
Can I interrupt and ask a question on this? Something that's always interested me: would people who play hobby games, if that's what one calls this, are they more likely to sit and read rules? I mean, I would assume that anybody that wants to play my games are not. I mean, Jenga has three rules, and people don't even read that. I'm just wondering whether there's this whole. Maybe that's what makes the difference between the games, is there's willingness to actually.
I think that's right. I think to some extent, I don't think people really enjoy it. I should say some people do, but I think they may not represent the majority. But there's a language to them, I think. And so once you sort of begin to learn the language, I think reading and comprehending the rules is a lot faster, where if you pick up a rule book and you haven't been exposed to the space, everything's foreign. It's like learning a foreign language almost for a lot of people. And then God help you if you're doing it in front of your friends in real time. there's just a halt. There's performance anxiety. You're trying to decode the rules. At the same time, you're trying to explain them, which is just a nightmare. So there's so many things can go wrong there.
But it's worth saying that things have improved so much over the last two or three decades. In the episode before this one, I was talking to Jervis Johnson, who was the lead game designer at Games Workshop for a long time. And one of his favorite games from the time is Kremlin, originally a Swiss game, and published by Avalon Hill, a superb, not exactly a simulation, more a satire of the power struggles within power blocks to take control of the Politburo during the Cold War. Going back to that today, that Avalon Hill rulebook is almost literally impenetrable. I mean, I loved the game back at the time, but it is so dense, and it's written like a computer manual in numbered paragraphs and sub-paragraphs and sub-sub-paragraphs. And yeah, we don't realize how far we've come, that what it's possible to boil a game of that complexity now down to maybe 8 pages of concise and crisp and clear rules. But it's interesting you said earlier on that the prototype version was a lot more complex, because this is something I hear over and over again, that the designer's ideal version or original version of the game is much, much more complicated and then gets stripped down, possibly in playtest. But there's another one that Ian Livingston was talking about in the first episode, The Warlord, which is it's basically Risk with nuclear weapons. It's kind of very much of its time. It was a 70s game, though it is still available today. And Games Workshop republished it, but they stripped it down to about half the game and called it Apocalypse. And it was a commercial success at that level, because The Warlord was simply too big and too dense, and there was too much game going on there. So yeah, it's the ongoing simplification, I think, was going to lead inevitably to games that are simply, because they're simpler, they're more social, there's more room for because there's less rules, there's more space for social interaction and social fun. And less of the kind of the brain burnery aspects, though brain burner games and games that require huge amounts of thought. And I'm thinking again here of Pandemic, and particularly because we're talking about 2016, which I think was the year Pandemic Legacy Season 1 came out. Matt, that was a game that combined, as you said, cooperative game mechanics, which were comparatively new, along with legacy game mechanics, the half that Rob Daviau, your co-designer, brought to it. How was it, first of all, combining those two elements? What were your inspirations generally for bringing the two together? And where do new mechanics come from?
Let's see how to tackle all that.
Sorry, once again, I'm asking 4 or 5 questions all at once.
Well, the idea of a Pandemic Legacy game was suggested to me by the publisher. We were looking at, you know, how can you make Pandemic the dice game? You know, whenever you have a success, they looked for how to capitalize it. And I kept putting off Pandemic Legacy because it seemed way too hard. I was working a full-time job at a startup at the time, and I just couldn't imagine trying to put something like that together. But the idea just kept clawing back at me all the time. I just saw all these different opportunities for storytelling. So I started filling a notebook, and the ideas were just overflowing. So I reached out to Rob Daviau, who had done Risk Legacy, which I had enjoyed. And we eventually got in touch, and he assured me that things would be really fun, and then they'd be really horrible, and then they'd be really fun again. And we dove into a partnership, just trying to figure out what something like that could be. It was just a lot of experimenting, really. It was a joy to work on with him. He's a really creative fellow, an amazing writer. I think for the first season, we took a hard look at all the different kinds of things I'd experimented with Pandemic and tried to figure out how to string them together in a narrative. And we settled on a structure first. This whole idea of each game being like an episode of a series. That concept unlocked all sorts of different tropes and I guess I'd say techniques for storytelling that you'd find in TV and in movies, that we started to really look at storytelling and what makes good stories, and drew a lot of those techniques out and applied them to our game. So we looked at like beat analysis and how to leave people kind of hanging at the end of a game and how to introduce a problem and then give them the solution at the beginning of the next one and draw them through. So it was just fascinating. It was just this wonderful little toy box to play in for those years.
Yeah, it looks, one takes it apart and looks at it, and it looks so simple. The structure looks so self-evident. And I'm sure it was, as you used the word years there, I'm sure there were years of development.
Each one was about, the first one took maybe 14 months. The second one took over 2 years. I'm sorry, the third one took over 2 years. It was just harder and harder.
Season zero.
Zero took, 2 years and maybe 2 months, something like that, to design.
So here's a question for both of you, because Matt, I mean, Pandemic Legacy went to the top of the Board Game Geek list and stayed there for a while. Leslie, of course, 80 million copies, it's hard to argue with. What's the moment where you realize that you've got something really good, that what you've created is possibly bigger than you imagined it could be?
Ooh, if I'm going to answer that from me, I mean, there's a sort of two points to that. One is that when I took Jenga to market, I thought it was going to be very big. And I thought it was going to, I'd seen enough people playing it. It had huge potential. What I didn't realize was that I didn't know anything about the toy market. So there was this huge gap between, and I would say that anybody that takes anything to market thinks it's going to be hugely successful. You don't risk what you have to risk to do something like that if you don't actually believe in it. What the effort that was involved in taking it to market, as in, you know, all the hurdles you come up against, and in my case, I came up against in actually trying to convince the toy market that what they wanted was this game.
Yes, and certainly the British toy market in the early 80s was fiercely conservative.
It was very conservative, but it was also, it had sort of slightly moved away, the toy market had slightly moved away from the whole concept of board games, because it had all started the computer games had started, and it was only actually because of Trivial Pursuit. I will argue that showed that you know, not only was there a market for board games, but actually a market for quite expensive board games. I mean, it was completely contrary to what everybody thought, and because that came out of Canada. The Canadians were looking for the next big idea for toy markets, and everybody was looking to Canada to come up with the next real pursuit.
In the hope that lightning would strike twice.
Yes, and so once Irwin Toy of Canada saw it and saw at Jenga, and they thought they took it on and they put it on their trade show. It was almost, I can't remember the exact number, but it was like 40 or 60,000 units they sold there. I had sold maybe 2,000 in the 3 years that I'd been trying to sell. I mean, it was huge. And so if you think about sort of like that moment where I knew it was going to, that I knew that it had a chance to be successful, that was that moment. It was in 1986, when Irwin took it. But one of the reasons I think why they had attracted it was that there was this idea that if Irwin had something out there, it was going to be good. You know, it was worth, the toy market decided they were going to go for it. And so I don't know whether that answered your question about, you know, when do you think there was going to be happen? That was the moment that I thought, well, it really is going to happen. But I tell you, in 1982, when I was talking to my bank manager, I was 100% convincing him it was going to be huge from the start, which, of course, was very naive of me.
Yeah. But Matt, I mean, your perspective must have been slightly different, because this wasn't your first rodeo. You'd had a bunch of games out. What was the moment that you, I don't know if it was just you or you and Rob went, you know, I think this could be huge?
I'm not going to lie. We did look at the Board Game Geek rankings from, you know, week to week and saw the trajectory the thing was on. And that was extremely exciting, because it was just on a rocket ship when that was going up. So that was one thing. When it hit number one on January 1st, that was a cause for celebration. That was pretty great. That and there's nothing like the moment where you're invited to go to the Spiel des Jahres awards. I had been there before, and it's just so exciting.
Yeah, it's I've never been. I've only ever watched the telecasts and stuff. I was talking to Rainer Knizia, who of course has won the Spiel des Jahres, but been so often the bridesmaid rather than the bride, has been nominated so many times. I think in all three categories. As well, I got the sense he didn't say he was a little jaded. I feel he may be a little jaded about the Spiel. But okay, what's it like being at the Spiel des Jahres?
It's just electric. You're in the audience, and no one knows what's going to happen. And many times you're there with your friends and with your colleagues. And it's been fun for me to actually be able to attend with other friends who were nominated at the same time, whether they were for other publishers or just designer friends. I was there with Susan McKinley Ross when Corkle was up against, I think, Forbidden Island at the time, and she was so excited.
I'd forgotten the two of you. Yeah,
I was there. I think I was there four times, or maybe one time was piped in. And I was a bridesmaid three times, and then got the special prize for season two. But I mean, everyone's looking in the juror's eyes, trying to get some sort of tell. there's nothing quite like it.
Yes, I had by coincidence, I had the chance to have a coffee with the jury chair a week before this year's awards, and said, of course, well, you know, do you think this year's going to have a worthy winner? He said, we don't know what's won yet. We don't decide until literally the day before, because they're so afraid of leaks, because the announcement has such commercial value, you know, a potential 500,000 extra sales. That's really important information. So they literally put off the final decision until the very last minute, which I thought was, I mean, it makes perfect sense, but seemed extraordinary. But yes, it's become this cultural force as an award, as the kind of almost the arbiter of what people will be playing for the next year or so. Leslie, speaking of, I mentioned play, you've stepped away from, I believe, from games design and games publishing. And at the moment you're looking into, you're studying the nature of play, what play is, why it is we play. And at the same time, you've been a witness to the games industry through these four or five decades of huge change. Is play static? Is the nature of play changing?
Well, in a sense, the whole essence of this work that I'm working with, and I'm working with the Pitt Rivers Museum here in Oxford, which is it's anthropological museum, is that there's an awful lot of work out there published, and a lot of very eminent people that have actually considered what play is from very different angles. You know, my husband's a zoologist, animal behaviorist for a start. So obviously, play when you're looking at an elephant or something which as he does, is one thing. I mean, it's defined in one way, and then what we're doing at play at various levels is defined in so many different ways, and by so many different people in so many different ways, that rather than actually try to do something where I'm trying to say this is what play is, as though it is something that can be boiled down to one definition, is that I'm going for the various ways that we use the word play, and in the context of I mean, Brian Sutton Smith wrote that fantastic book about the ambiguity of play. This is like, and he's talking about sort of seven different ways of looking at the ambiguity of play. Looking at play from sort of seven different sort of rhetorics, if you like. I'm taking it even further. I don't know whether I'm taking it further. What I'm doing is saying we use play in this way, you use the word play in this way, and et cetera. And just highlighting how we use the term play, or illustrating how we use the term play, under, so far, under probably about 150 different headings.
Oh.
In a way, I'm not trying to make a thesis, a sort of thesis that goes the whole way from A to B and saying, now I end up with the conclusion of what play is. What I'm actually saying is play is really multifaceted. And we can use play when we're talking about something that's pretty serious. And we can use play, you can use play right from sort of literally an actor, in a theatre is playing, through to a child who's mucking about in a completely unstructured way, to, I don't know, sex play or politic play, politics as play. And I mean, it would take me all evening to describe all the various things, but there's some wonderful examples of how we use play, and it has taken me back to sort of even looking at when the earliest examples of what we think that human was playing, the finding of what they assume of randomizers, as in the sort of astragalus bones and things like that, which is like 10,000 years ago. And was that play? I mean, is when you're gambling, is that play? And what was it then? And
yes, was there the structure on top of it that would turn it into a game? Or was it just, game is, play with a structure and a purpose and usually an end point?
So I'm finding it extremely exciting, incredibly difficult to do, because I thought I sort of got 150 headings and I thought, there I go, we just got it. And then every single one of them has taken me down rabbit holes. And so I'm hoping it's almost like an encyclopedia of play, where you're looking up the word play in being used in a particular context. And then I'm just sort of, in a sense, showing examples or thinking about examples. So is it static? Has it moved on? I think it's incredibly diverse, and always has been, what it is that's happening when we do what we call play, when we engage in play.
I'm fascinated by your 150 different types of play, because that reminds me of Jeff Engelstein's book, which came out a couple of years ago, I think, The Building Blocks of Tabletop Game Design, mm-hmm. which lists, I think, 180 different game mechanics and breaks them down and shows how they've been used in different games. And based off that, I went back to look when we started using the term game mechanic and started thinking about these discrete things. Which, I mean, academics call them ludemes, and the two terms aren't exactly the same. But according to Google Ngrams, the one that their algorithm that tracks word usage over time, there was a computer games magazine that talked about game mechanics in the late 80s for a bit. And then it's almost unused until about 2005. Uh-huh. And then at which point people start talking about game mechanics as a concept, and the idea that you can take a game apart and take the cogs out of a piece of cogwork and reuse them in other places. At which point there's this explosion in creativity and new concepts, and just from this new way of thinking about games. Something very much happening at the moment, the increasing academization of game studies, the understanding of what games are and how they work. I don't have a question arising out of that, but I do, because an awful lot of it is coming from academics, and the vast majority of them are not games designers. They may be games players, but they're not games designers. They've not approached games from a design point of view. Whereas, Leslie, you have. You've thought, obviously you've been at the hard end of things for some time as a designer and as a publisher. Do you think this gives you a substantially different insight onto play and gameplay?
I think it gives me a particular angle, yes. I mean, I would think, I can't help seeing play as, every time any use of the word play, I would sort of bring it down to sort of thinking about what I've obviously got a games designer's lens, if you like, at looking at that. I don't know whether it gives me any further insights. It's just but arising from having spent sort of, 40 years of my life designing games, I'm actually fascinated at the idea that there isn't a definition of what playing a game is. There just isn't a definition. I mean, we don't even know that what, say, animals are doing where we call it play, whether they actually, I mean, I don't think you would necessarily define it as a game. You know, what is a game comes into it as much as anything else. So it's a, I don't know whether that's answered your question, but I think I can't help but look at it through that lens. But whether I have any deeper insights, I'm not sure.
Well, I look forward to reading the results of what you come up with. It sounds fascinating. Matt, I mean, do you approach game design from a game mechanical point of view as a piece of engineering? I mean, you were talking about beats and storytelling and all of that for Pandemic Legacy. To what extent is it the concept and thinking about how this is going to engage with players or how it's going to work mechanically? What's on top for you?
Yeah, I think when I started out, it was all done just intuitively. I throw a lot of stuff together, throw it on the table and see what sticks. Now I try to be a little bit more deliberate about it. So, I mean, part of that is just like looking back and trying to figure out what worked before and understand it. You know, reverse engineer your success and try to figure out if you can. Because it's difficult to come up with any new game, and then to come up with something great is tough. So I try to start with the emotions. I just try to figure out like what is this game going to make people feel like, or what do I want people to feel like? You know, I want them to feel creative or excited or scared, or and just look at what kind of a, like an emotional journey. I mean, a lot of the cooperative games I've got have kind of a similar structure, and they're designed to actually create lots of tension and release and so on. So I start with that kind of emotional part and then figure out what kind of dynamics, like how is the game going to change during play in order to generate those kinds of emotions. And that leads to the mechanisms, you know, like what can I put in there to make those changes happen to make people feel the way they feel. And that's I think that's called the MDA framework or something like that, some nerdy thing. So that works for me. That really appeals to me, because I think at the end of the day I'm really trying to, you know, figure out how to not in some kind of like creepy social media type of way, you know, where you're trying to create engagement, but you really want to draw people in and create a like a context for people to have an experience together across the table. So that's sort of how I think about it. So I don't start with just a random bag of mechanisms and just see how are they going to collide. There's some of that, you know, because you have to experiment. You're not exactly sure what's gonna work and what's not. But if you're just kind of doing it blindly, you end up with you know, a game that's just sort of a random grab bag of these mechanisms kind of stapled together under an umbrella of a theme, and those are fine, but I think it's harder to get them to break through into something bigger if you're not really thinking about the endpoint, the emotions. You might just end up with a game that's perfectly playable and fine, and you know, you play it once and you put it on the shelf if you go the other direction, I think.
There does seem, I'm not going to name anyone here, it does seem that the last 10 years has produced an awful lot of perfectly fine games, quite a lot of them through Kickstarter, I have to say.
the barrier for entry is low now, and so there's just lots of them, and it's so important to stand out now that you really need to up your game in order to.
It's not enough for a game to be just fine anymore.
Yeah, it's not okay.
I know you've been working on
Daybreak,
which, as you mentioned at the start, has this environmental theme, the idea of, you know, trying to keep the world going. And this, along with the party game theme, is one of the dominant themes, I think, of the last few years, games with a kind of an eco or environmental theme, or at least an environmental setting. Cascadia, which won the Spiel this year, beautiful game. It's because it feels like a traditional game, and then you look at the mechanics and it's drafting, and it's really comparatively new things, but it's using them in what feels like quite a traditional way. Lovely, lovely game. Obviously you're tapping into, and I think that's, my guess would be there's been this kind of emphasis on nature-based games because of people's anxiety about what's happening to the natural world, even though these games, the vast majority of them, don't do anything or say anything about that particular theme, and indeed are not produced with a particular eye to sustainable design or production, which is a whole other kettle of fish that I don't think we've got time to go into. Leading on to a bigger question, so what comes next? Where are we looking in terms of theme? What do you think that's coming through? What can we look forward to in the way of themes or games development or new styles of play in the next few years?
I'm not sure the environmental stuff is coming from this anxiety so much as it is maybe a reaction to a lot of the other so many classical games have been about, like, you know, you got your fantasy tropes, you got your Italian princes trading spices in the Mediterranean or whatnot. It just, so much of that stuff just feels so tired. I mean, a lot of us like to drop into those worlds and explore and so on, but I think publishers have recognized that there's a lot of other people who are not playing games right now, and those may not be the right stories to tell to attract them. And so if you come out with these beautiful games that tap into, like, biophilia or love of nature, that are warm, that everybody can get behind, that you're, we all know what nature is. It's also not like fiercely competitive, right? You can get into a lot of these games and you're all trying to do something positive together potentially. So I think that may be part of why those games have been so appealing lately. So I'd expect to see more of the same, maybe not more nature necessarily, but other games that are not, for example, of these older, more tired themes that might attract new players. So I mean, like, Wingspan is one. I mean, it's the natural world, but I think it appealed to a whole swath of new kinds of players that are then brought into the hobby space and discover those. So I would hope to see more of that happening.
You mentioned Wingspan, which brings me to one other point. One of the elephants in the room with the Spiel, and I do talk about it in the book, is that only one Spiel des Jahres winner has ever been designed by a woman, Susan McKinley Ross, who you mentioned earlier on for Quirkle. Leslie, you were perhaps the second best-selling female games designer of all time after Elizabeth McGee, who created Monopoly, and she did create Monopoly. She called it the Landlord's Game. When the design was stolen from her, it became Monopoly. I'm going to be completely blunt about that, but that is what happened. I mean, obviously, having designed your game, you've run companies within the industry. How has the position of women within the games industry, generally, or the profile of women within the games industry, have you been aware of it changing? It seems to me that it's still very white and very male. And
I think it is. I think it is very white and very male still. But I think there's some quite significant work being done actually in the States and in Chicago by people who are, I'm going to point specifically at the Chicago Toy and Games Festival Fair, and now the Taggies, the Toy and Games Inventors, I don't know what the E stands for actually, awards, which a woman called Mary Cousins. Do you know Mary Cousins?
I know the name.
Well, she started this about 15 years ago. I mean, it wasn't specifically aimed at raising the profile of women. It was aimed at raising the profile of designers and with the people behind toys and games, which I think in America, let's put it the other way. In Germany, I think there's been and German-speaking countries, I think there's been a long tradition of recognizing designers behind toys and games, and games in particular. In the States and in the UK, it's not just women that haven't been recognized. It's toys and it's the designers across the board and are only just beginning to be, have their names put on the back of a box and this sort of thing. And I think there's an awful lot that Chicago toy people and Mary Cousin and with the Taggy have done to to raise that profile. And along with that comes the profile of women designers have been, they are out there. I mean, for an example is my daughter. I mean, she's a board game designer, and her name's on the back on the outside of any games that she's been involved with. And these are people like, Ravensburger probably would always have done it, but some sort of quite traditional toy publishers, games publishers.
I think Ravensburger, unless for a long time didn't. I don't think Scotland Yard's design is accredited. I don't think Enchanted. Enchanted Forest. I'm trying to picture the boxes, but yes, but they've come round to it now. I'm sure.
I think. Well, they, but it kicking and screaming. I might say from the publisher's point of view. So, I mean, the more of that happens, the more there will be women recognised. I think. I don't know whether that answers it. I mean, have I seen a difference? I've certainly seen a difference, and I think it started in 15 years ago when the taggies started.
I mean, there's always been a lot of women behind the scenes working in the publishing. I mean, TSR, the publishers of Dungeons and Dragons, were their CEO was a woman for, I think, the mid-80s to the mid-90s, for the majority of the company's existence. And things like that. And there have been many others, and within Hasbro, within other companies as well. But kind of having a public profile, it does feel like there's a lack there. When I said that only one woman has won the Spiel, there were a couple of others, and I'm blanking on the names, but they tend to be the team games. One of the designers of Scotland Yard was female. One of the designers of Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective was a woman. But Susan McKinley Ross is the only solo designer who's a woman who's won the Spiel.
Include the Kenner Spiel, you've got Wingspan, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about the main Spiel because that's the focus of my book, Matt. Okay, yeah. To be completely mercenary about this. Yes, I mean, you've got the Kinder, you've got the Kenner, and of course...
Well, the special prize is really the only one that matters, right?
Yeah. And Karen Seyfarth as well, and for Tone of Taxis. Oh, jeez. It seems like every episode I go, oh, Thurn and Taxis, so good, such a good... Anyway, to wrap all of this up, to kind of bring this onto a bit more of a personal note, thinking back over the last 10 years, if you had to pick one game that you've particularly enjoyed, it's significant either for you, or you think is significant for the market, or you just think is interesting in a particular way, what game kind of jumps forward? Not something that you were personally involved in.
One that stands out for me for a number of those criteria is The Crew, the cooperative trick-taking game. So I believe that won a Kenner Spiel, which seems strange because it seems like it would qualify for the main prize given its simplicity.
It's not a complex game.
No, it's just, and it starts out so simple. It's just a very straightforward, at the beginning, trick-taking game. But unlike every other trick-taking game, it's cooperative. So you're all trying to satisfy one objective, and if you do it, then you win, and then you go on to the next mission, and that's just ever so slightly harder, and you keep going in this way until you can complete up to like 40 or 50 missions depending on the product. And I just really enjoy this. It's really easy to get to the table. If you've ever played a trick-taking game, it feels very natural. It's got that quality that I like in games where it feels like someone just discovered this. They didn't design it. It was just like, oh, this was just laying here and I found it. And, you know, let's try it. Because it feels so obvious in its design to some extent. That one really, really stands out for me.
Seems to come from a very simple place. It seems it's basically kind of what if whist, but cooperative. And it's, you know, each turn or each round you're set conditions for what sort of tricks you need to take. And as you say, it's such a simple concept. It does feel like it was found rather than designed.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful way to introduce people to trick-taking games because it's cooperative, right? You're not going to be brutally taken out. I think it's a great way to learn lots of different kinds of trick-taking games, lots of different techniques as you're playing, because it just gives you all sorts of different challenges and forces you to think in different ways. And it's just really great problem-solving, but it's generative. It's just a very simple set of rules, and it creates all sorts of different problems for everybody to solve together. So that one stands out for me as a co-op that you know, is very different from the cooperative games that I've designed that I like to bring up for friends.
Leslie,
can I say that I was reintroduced to a game? Is that
of course, yes.
I mean, do you know the game Pit?
Oh, I love Pit. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I use Pit to teach games.
Well, Pit was a game that I grew up playing, if you like. I don't know whether quite, but when I don't remember it came out. So
1909 or something like that. Yeah,
something. It's pre First World War. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's oh, so it was a game that I loved as a child, and then I don't know that it was available or whatever, but it suddenly seems to have become available again in the last few years, and it's. So I spend a lot of time out in Kenya. We go to a very remote place and I spend sort of 2 or 3 months out there. And I take the games that I take out there that I love. I mean, Pit, I just love that. And Boggle. I mean, I know this is, I'm sorry, I'm very much more recently I was introduced to sort of Carcassonne when I was there. And so, and Pandemic, actually. I Kenya. Coming out of a pandemic, they're playing Pandemic. So yes, it's sort of those are the ones that stick in my mind.
No, it's an interesting story, and you know, good games never go away. They're you know, they're still fresh. Pit is still, it's the game I've been told to stop playing at games events more than any others because it gets so loud. I would actually go for a much gentler cooperative card game. Wolfgang Wash's The Mind. Which is incredibly simple. I don't know if you know it, Leslie. It's simply cards numbered 1 to 100. And you each get a hand of it. Well, on round one, you each get one card. And you have to play them in the correct numerical order, lowest to highest, without talking to each other. And it's incredible. That's basically the rules. And then round two, it's two cards. And round three, it's three cards. And there are a few special cards for saving lives and things. But it's incredibly simple. But when it's going well, when you're kind of staring across the table and there's a long pause and someone puts down 67 and someone puts 68 and someone puts 69, it's the closest I've ever felt to being genuinely psychic. There's a bonding moment among the players that's unlike anything I've felt in games before. And there's a couple that get close. There's Wavelength, which is another Wolfgang Wash with a crew of other designers. And there's a game called Medium, which is about shouting out the same word at the same time, which is very clever. And it, for me, I think that I want to see more of that kind of thing. I think it's something that games have just realized that they can do. They can create this extraordinary feeling of a bond, a togetherness, a sameness, a shared thought, and more of that. I hope to see more of those because those are really fun. And Wolfgang Wash, again, like yourself, Matt, has been up for the main prize on several occasions, and I would say cruelly deprived it, though I'm not going to say which games I think shouldn't have won.
He picked up one for Quacks of Quedlinburg, so
yeah, he got the Kenner, not the main prize, but yes, but no, it's you know, I think an interesting designer. I look forward to the year that he goes up against you for the main prize. I'll be making some very careful predictions that year, I think. Matt, Leslie, thank you so much for this. This has been absolutely delightful, insightful, illuminating, and really fun. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you both for your time so much.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, James.
This is the Play to Win podcast from Aconite Books with me, James Wallace. This first series of the podcast accompanies my new book, Everybody Wins. 4 decades of the greatest board games ever made. Out now in the UK and coming to the US, Canada and Australia in spring 2023. My huge thanks to Matt and Leslie for a very interesting discussion. I'm never quite sure where these things are going to go, where the questions will lead us. It's never quite where I expect. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. A few notes. Pandemic and its offshoots, including the Pandemic Legacy Trilogy of Season 1, Season 2 and Season 0, start with Season 1, are available from Z-Man Games, garlanded with awards. The game Daybreak that Matt described will be published in 2023, co-designed with Matteo Menapace, There is still time to back it on the website BackerKit if you want to get in on the pre-orders. Leslie's game Jenga is available almost literally everywhere. Her other games include Ex Libris, the game of first lines and last words, the Great Western Railway game, Anagrams, Tabula and Bookworm, many still available from Oxford Games. I hope you'll join me for episode 6, a roundup discussion looking back into the past and forward into the future. My guests will be Tim Harford, best known as the host of Radio 4's More or Less, Chris Eggert, the editor of Tabletop Gaming Magazine, and Holly Nielsen, the games scholar and writer.